We moved from NITSE to mayor, and from the inner workings of the State Department of Arms Control to presidential photography. Bob Mayer is museum director at the International Museum of Photography, George Eastman House in Rochester. He was born in New York. He did his undergraduate work and received a Bachelor of Arts degree, magna cum laude, at Fairleigh Dickinson University. He did graduate work in international relations and Latin American affairs and history at New York University. He's had a broad and yet focused career as beginning as manager of an advertising department in a bank, program supervisor of an advertising department in Mobil Oil Company. He was a key force in the Latin American program of the Ford Foundation, serving in Brazil as a senior officer, and then as officer in charge of logistical services in New York and assistant to the vice president of the Ford Foundation. He served as director of the New York Community Trust and then executive director of the New York Council on the Arts. He's been a member of a number of boards, including the editorial board of Grants Magazine. He's the author of several plays, La Borgia, Alejandra, They'll Grow Roses being three. He's worked with various arts groups in Rochester, Bucket Theater Group, a very successful group, dance group in Rochester, and has reached out to arts programs throughout the state and throughout the country. We thought that along with presidential cartoonists, whom we also have had speak, that in one or two other areas that we've explored, non-conventional areas perhaps in presidential scholarship, that presidential photography was at an important point in our perception of presidents.
Thank you. We're going to stand to do this a little easier. And then I'll move to the slides. For the last 150 years of the 200 years of the American presidency, we've been fortunate to have had a mechanism which has at times enhanced and at other times diminished, but most times enhanced, the presidential image. In this year of 1989, we celebrated the 200th anniversary of the presidency. This same year, we have celebrated the discovery of photography in France 150 years ago. Almost from the moment of its discovery, the photographic process has had its effect upon the presidency of the United States. It has presented to the public a careful documentation of the presidential image, reaching back even beyond its 150 years by two presidential terms, so that there exists a rich photographic record of 34 of the 40 men who have held that office. The first five presidents, Washington through Monroe, had all died before photography had been discovered, no less reached the shores of the United States in 1840. The stature of the founding fathers has been romanticized for Americans through dramatic paintings, oftentimes highly idealized portraits, which frequently belied the facts, such as the 5'4" height of James Madison, or the embittered pugnacity of John Adams. The mythology of that heroic imagery came to an end for all time with the truthfulness of the camera lens. Besides the first five presidents, one other, William Henry Harrison, also died before being photographed, at least as far as anyone knows. An early daguerreotype exists of Harrison, but from all evidence, it is a photograph of a painting and not of the man himself. Had he lived to serve his full term, a photographic image of him would undoubtedly have been made, since the first sitting president to be known to have a photographic sitting was John Tyler, the vice president who ascended to the presidency upon Harrison's untimely death. We read in John Quincy Adams's memoirs that on April 12, 1844, He was at the daguerreotype studio of Edward Anthony and J.M. Edwards in Washington when Tyler and his son visited the studio. We also have photographic evidence, which I will show you in a few moments, of two other daguerreotype sittings of Tyler. When photography first touched the lives of Americans, it did so through the establishment of daguerreotype studios in the major cities of the United States, as well as through the efforts of itinerant daguerreans who traveled from town to town, taking pictures generally of the affluent citizens of each community before moving on to the next village. Adams recorded in his memoirs visits in 1843 to two such daguerrean studios in Utica, New York, and Cincinnati, Ohio, besides visits to Edwards and Anthony's Washington studio. Since a daguerreotype is a unique, one-of-a-kind image, photographers learned quickly to make daguerreotype copies of their daguerreotypes if they wanted to sell more than one copy of an image to a sitter. Later, when other reproducible photographic processes came into existence, photographers often copied their earlier daguerreotypes with them, providing examples for sale to an even broader audience. That concept, marketing of photographic images, is an important factor in the relationship of photography and the presidency, almost from the beginning of the confluence of the two. It has always been a major motivational influence for photographers who aspire to take presidential portraits, and it has shaped the way those images taken have entered the public arena. Even in the daguerrean era, before other means of photographic reproduction were possible, we find photographers marketing their daguerreotypes of presidents, either through daguerreotype copies or engravings made from them. Albert Sands Southworth and Josiah Johnson Hawes, two of America's most famous daguerreans, in 1848 solicited letters attesting to the quality of their likeness of Zachary Taylor from officers who had served with him in the Mexican War. The Southworth and Hawes daguerreotype of Taylor is actually a copy of one taken by another photographer, believed to be James McGuire of New Orleans. One Washington newspaper, after viewing an engraving made from a daguerreotype taken by Matthew Brady of Taylor in his cabinet, said, quote, "We have no doubt that Mr. Brady will receive a handsome income from the sale of this magnificent picture. At least we hope so, for he is a man of industry and deserves it," unquote. John Plum Jr., an early daguerrean who set up studios in more than a dozen cities, created his National Plumotype Gallery in 1847, marketing lithographs made from his daguerreotypes of famous Americans. Edwards and Anthony formed a National Daguerrean Gallery from the likenesses they made of their Washington sitters. Unfortunately, a fire in 1852 destroyed all of these except one of John Quincy Adams. And Matthew Brady, not to be outdone, published his Gallery of Illustrious Americans in 1850. It was the invention of the albumen photographic process and its use to make small cardboard-mounted copies called cartes de visite that propelled forward the marketing of photograph portraits of the famous, and who could be more famous than the President of the United States. As people collected cartes de visite portraits of their families and friends and put them in albums, they also collected portraits of presidents and other famous people. At antique shows and flea markets, one can still find old family albums with copies of cartes de visite of Abraham Lincoln, Andrew Johnson, or Ulysses S. Grant. One of the critical dates in the history of photography and the presidential image is February 27, 1860. It was the day that Lincoln stepped into Brady's New York studio prior to his famous speech at Cooper Union and had his portrait taken. Cartes de visite bearing that image of the beardless Lincoln, Currier and Ives lithographs made from it, and its publication as a woodcut in Frank Leslie's Illustrated Weekly brought this little-known Illinois lawyer to the attention of Americans all over the country. Several years later, on seeing Brady at a White House function, Lincoln remarked, quote, "Brady and the Cooper Union may be President of the United States," unquote. Photographs taken of Lincoln in Brady's studios are among the most famous we have of that president. You can think of the $5 bill, about whom Carl Sandburg would later write, quote, "Not until his advent into the White House did the camera seem to become an instrument functioning up to its possibilities," unquote. Brady, throughout his career, would take photographs of 18 presidents, from John Quincy Adams to William McKinley, with the only exception being William Henry Harrison. Other photographers, however, also took important photographs of Lincoln before his 1860 election. One of those, Alexander Hessler of Chicago, took a series of portraits in Springfield, of which Lincoln himself said, quote, "That looks better and expresses me better than any I have seen. If it pleases the people, I am satisfied," unquote. It obviously satisfied many, because during his lifetime, Hessler sold 10,000 copies of two of the poses from that June 1860 sitting. The 1860 election saw another photographic process impact on the presidential scene. Although evidence exists that tintype campaign pins were used in 1856, a year after that process was developed, most photographic and campaign histories attribute 1860 as the start for the usage of photographic pins in presidential elections. Worn on lapels, many of these showed the presidential candidate on the one side and the vice presidential candidate on the reverse. In 1860, these were produced in matching sets for all four candidates: Lincoln, Stephen Douglas, John Bell, and John Breckinridge. Here again, in the earliest years of photographic history, we encounter the successful marketing of the presidential image by enterprising photographers. The last half of the 19th century witnessed a continuation of the formal presidential photographic portrait produced in a format for mass distribution and sale. The larger cardboard-backed cabinet card replaced the small carte de visite in popularity. We find cabinet cards of presidents and their first ladies being made and sold to the public up to the time of Woodrow Wilson. At the same time, we begin to find other uses of photography intersecting with the lives of the presidents in office or even before taking office. The stereotype, or stereo view as it is more commonly known, gained popularity during the Civil War and continued to be produced in ever-growing quantities up to the mid-1920s. The capability of the three-dimensional effect provided by stereo views encouraged photographers to record scenes and actual events rather than merely portraits. Thus, the public began to see its president in other than static settings. We find by the time of William McKinley, production of boxed sets of stereo views of presidential activities sold for educational purposes. Scholars of the stereotype have identified at least 106 different views showing McKinley, 212 of Theodore Roosevelt, and over 100 alone depicting events surrounding McKinley's funeral. A boxed set of stereo views was produced by Keystone View Company, documenting Warren Harding's fateful last trip across the country to Alaska. In the early years of the 20th century, popular weekly magazines, such as Everybody's Magazine and Collier's, began to contract with prominent portrait and other photographers to take photographs of the president for reproduction in their pages. We find such well-known artists as Alvin Langdon Coburn, Edward Steichen, Arnold Genthe, and Nicholas Murai producing such portraits in the first quarter of this century. As with the dynamic changes in photographic capability created with the 1850s inventions of albumen prints and tintypes, the 1920s and 1930s saw other major changes. Small handheld cameras were developed. Mass circulation news magazines were brought to the newsstands, and the transmission of photographs over telephone lines became possible. These advances caused controversy early in the administration of Franklin Roosevelt. Photographers using a small candid camera were temporarily barred from the White House because a series of unflattering photographs of the president at a ball game were published. A combination of the intense sunlight on Roosevelt's face, poor enlargement from the small negative, and the then relatively poor transmission of photographs over telephone lines made the resulting published photographs portray the president as in ill health, causing a scare around the country that he was dying. This was in 1937. However, shortly afterward, photographs of presidents in action anywhere in the world, coupled with almost simultaneous transmission of those images to daily newspapers or weekly news magazines, changed the public presentation of the presidency. It did nothing to change the factor of photographs of the president being used to bolster sales, albeit through increased circulation of those newspapers and magazines rather than individual sales of photographs. As the modern presidency emerged during the terms of Franklin Roosevelt, government itself entered the presidential image creation business. From the time of Roosevelt to John F. Kennedy, military photographers worked for the White House, documenting various events, including the haunting photograph of Lyndon Johnson taking the oath of office aboard Air Force One upon the assassination of Kennedy. Johnson was particularly aware of the value of photography in image making and was the first president to appoint a personal photographer to the president. All of his successors, with the exception of Jimmy Carter, have continued this practice. The current incumbent for George Bush is David Valdez. Thus, the presidency itself has become the handmaiden of the merchants of presidential imagery. Probably one of the most photographed men to hold the office of the presidency was Ronald Reagan. He was a master at image building, and we heard emerge during his incumbency the phrase photo opportunity. A future study of the Reagan presidency will probably point to the use of these photo opportunities as a masterful manipulation of the press at the White House, creating an image of activity and openness during a time of limited press availability. With no scientific analysis to back it up, I suggest that George Bush has received far less photographic coverage in the print media than Ronald Reagan did, even though Bush has held more frequent press conferences during his 10 months in office. Certainly, we have not seen as dramatic a series of Bush images as we did photographs of Reagan. I do not know if this is a commentary on the press, the president, or a faltering of photographic creativity. Now I would like to show you fairly rapidly a series of presidential images. And I don't know, I think you might be able to see this with or without.
Switch is right behind you.
Let's see if we can get this story. Okay. Now I can see it from here. Yeah, thanks. The first is a daguerreotype of Andrew Jackson. Now tell me if that's sharp, because I have not got my glasses on.
Oh. Good.
Okay. Good. Fortunately, Jackson, like John Quincy Adams and Martin Van Buren, lived long enough after their terms in office to be photographed. This image of Jackson, taken only months before his death in 1845, is attributed to Dan Adams of Nashville. It shows how the camera began to give us a truer picture of presidents than the familiar idealized paintings did. The next is of another daguerreotype. This is of James Knox Polk in the center, with the dark eyebrows, with his wife next to him on his left, as far as we're looking at it. And several other important people in presidential history. On the far left, almost obliterated by the tarnishing of a silver plate, is James Buchanan, then Secretary of State. And next to him, Harriet Lane, his niece and later White House hostess. To the right of Polk, as we're looking at it, in the white wimple, is Dolly Madison, the widow of the fourth president. It is believed that this photograph was taken by the painter George P.A. Healy, who, according to Polk's memoirs, attempted to take a daguerreotype at the White House of Polk, quote, the cabinet and the ladies in a group, unquote, on June 16, 1846. In his memoirs, Polk said that these pictures were unsuccessful, and yet in other descriptions that he talks about, the ladies with Mrs. Madison being in the parlor, is a picture obviously was one of the Healy portraits done at that time. This, as with the Jackson, I might comment, are both in the collection of the International Museum of Photography in Rochester. Earlier, I mentioned the copying of daguerreotypes onto other later photographic processes. Here are two examples that evidence other photographic sittings of John Tyler. One, this one, of Tyler, taken by Frederick and William Langenheim in Philadelphia, was reproduced as a glass lantern slide, which this is. One can see the note written on the slide's mount, ex-president Tyler from daguerreotype. This lantern slide carries the further inscription on top, which you cannot see, ex-president Tyler from life, 1844. And as you can see, the price of $2, an expensive item at that date. The other is a copy of a daguerreotype of Tyler by Brady, produced as a carte de visite. And these were the two I mentioned earlier, definite photo documentation of the sittings by Tyler. Next, we see a series of cartes de visite, all by Brady. The first four are copies of Brady daguerreotypes. We have John Quincy Adams, Andrew Jackson. This was also supposedly taken about two months before he died. James Knox Polk, and Polk's diaries identify about three different days that Brady came to visit him and take pictures in the White House. And we know that he was probably the first president who was photographed in the White House because of that documentation. And then Zachary Taylor. This next group of cartes de visite by Brady were produced directly as albumen prints. We have Martin Van Buren, who we've heard a lot about in the last election as being the last vice president that moved up to presidency. Remember. Millard Fillmore, Franklin Pierce, James Buchanan, the famous Cooper Union portrait of Abraham Lincoln. And that was the one that was so heavily documented at that time in the first campaign. And Andrew Johnson. This last picture, again, reminds us of the entrepreneurial motivations of photographers in relation to portraits of presidents or other famous Americans. In an 1861 letter to Johnson, then a United States Senator, Brady wrote, "Dear Sir, my stock of imperial specimen photographs having accumulated to such extent that I cannot exhibit one half of them, and believing it would be to my advantage to have yours exhibited in your district, I propose to sell it to you for the merely nominal sum of $10, much less than it costs to finish it." Unquote. I commented earlier that there is evidence that tintype portraits of presidential candidates on campaign pins did exist prior to the 1860 election, contrary to conventional belief. Here is an example, a tintype campaign clothing button for the 1856 American Party candidacy of Millard Fillmore. Recently, a matching button of James Buchanan, the successful Democratic candidate in that election, appeared at auction. I would not doubt that buried in somebody's attic, there exists a matching button for John Charles Fremont, the Republican candidate. This pin, which is actually in my own personal collection, is less than a half inch in width, probably closer to a quarter in width, very small. And it was used actually on clothing. You can see the hasp on the back that was sewn on clothes. Here are examples of 1860 campaign pins for Lincoln, Douglas, Bell, and Breckinridge. The Bell and the Breckinridge are from a matching set, although Douglas is the same size, it's different because it has his name on it, which neither of the others have. On the reverse of all four of these are the vice presidential candidates. Also, I talked about the Hessler pictures of Lincoln, of which the photographer sold some 10,000 copies. Here is one of the well-known poses. Although the cabinet card replaced the carte de visite in popularity during the late 1860s, it did nothing to invigorate the image of the presidency. Here are a series of cabinet card portraits spanning 50 years of presidential service. Ulysses S. Grant, and you can see these are really not exciting photographs. Maybe it was the men. Rutherford B. Hayes, James A. Garfield, Chester Allen Arthur, Grover Cleveland, Benjamin Harrison, William McKinley, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and Woodrow Wilson. One interesting cabinet card, which though static in presentation, did provide the public with a view of a special event, is this of the 100th anniversary of the birth of Daniel Webster. The picture shows Chester Alan Arthur standing there in the middle, next to Webster's widow, and a group of notables on the porch of the Webster home. The picture has numbers over the heads of people, and they are identified on the reverse of the card. Behind Mrs. Webster, to her, just to her left, behind her with a beard, that's Robert Todd Lincoln, who was Secretary of War for Arthur at the time. Stereo views broke the pattern of presidential imagery, showing them in more natural poses or on important occasions. This series of stereo views shows us Grant at his headquarters in Virginia during the Civil War. Now we're starting to see them in settings that are not just formal portraits. Grant with his wife during the war years and his son. Cleveland attending an Atlanta exposition. That's Cleveland in the front there turned around toward us. McKinley on one of his national tours, part of the extensive stereo documentation of his travels during his presidency. Theodore Roosevelt with representatives of Japan and Russia as he negotiated the peace treaty for which he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Taft on a speaking tour. Wilson with other Allied leaders at Versailles. And Harding on his last trip through the West. Although I had not mentioned it earlier, presidential images also appeared on photographically produced postcards, which were fairly common during the period from the late 1890s through the 1930s. These too usually captured the presidents in informal situations. McKinley observing the regimental colors at Fort Niagara, New York. Theodore Roosevelt visiting the old mission of the Franciscan Fathers in Santa Barbara, California. Taft attending a GAR reunion in Rochester, New York. Wilson riding in a carriage in Paris with President Poincaré of France. Harding on a fishing trip. And Calvin Coolidge in one of the many humorous situations in which this humorless man frequently found himself. Here are three examples of presidential photographs taken from magazines early in the century. Taft in 1908. Edward Steichen was paid $500 for taking this portrait for Everybody's magazine. Roosevelt in 1916, taken by Arnold Genta. And Taft dedicating the Lincoln Memorial on the Lincoln Farm in Hodgenville, Kentucky in November 1911, taken by J.H. Hare for Collier's. As press photography became more common, starting in the teens, we saw presidents in all kinds of situations. Wilson marching with GAR veterans in 1913. Wilson in San Francisco on his cross-country tour to save the League of Nations about 7 days before his debilitating stroke. Coolidge again posing in an unusual outfit. he really did it. Franklin Roosevelt speaking to Congress at the end of his first year in office. I think this was a speech in which he said to Congress, "I come to counsel with you," I believe it was fairly famous. Roosevelt signing a bill during wartime. Here you can start to see the aging distinctly of the president in that, with the mourning ribbon for war, which he wore. Henry Wallace right behind the president there. I guess it's Sam Rayburn right next to Wallace. And William Martin, I guess, next to Wallace, too. Harry Truman at Potsdam with Allied leaders Clement Attlee and Joseph Stalin in 1945. Like Henry Burns, with Burns in the back, and Molotov. The most famous photograph of Truman and Friend. Richard Nixon campaigning with vice presidential candidate Spiro Agnew in 1968. Looks like it should be the speech, "I am not a crook," rather than a campaign picture. Gerald Ford campaigning in 1976. And Ronald Reagan, Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, and Richard Nixon at the White House on the eve of the departure of the three ex-presidents for Egypt and Anwar Sadat's funeral. This picture was taken by Michael Evans, the personal photographer to President Reagan. Unique presidential events have always been grist for the photographer's mill. I want to finish up with a series of photographs that relate to such events. First, inaugurations. A stereo view of the parade for Grant's second inauguration in 1873. They even started back then. Actually, there are photographs of both of Lincoln's inauguration. I don't have a copy of it, so I couldn't make a slide, but they do exist. A stereo view of Cleveland's inauguration in 1885. A photograph of the crowd waiting in the rain for Harrison's inauguration in 1889. And one of Cleveland and McKinley at the latter's inauguration in 1897. A stereo view of Theodore Roosevelt's inauguration in 1905. A postcard of Taft and his wife in a carriage on inaugural day in 1909. And a postcard of Taft and Wilson at the latter's inauguration in 1913. A press photo of Wilson giving his inaugural address in 1917. Herbert Hoover congratulating Roosevelt in 1933. FDR taking the oath of office in 1937. A military display at FDR's 1941 inaugural parade. When I first saw this, I thought it might have been during the war, but it was marked, identified clearly as 1941. Truman taking the oath of office in 1949. The Eisenhowers and Nixons on inaugural day in 1957. Sam Rayburn over there on the left. The Kennedys and Johnson at the inaugural ball in 1961. Johnson being sworn in on Air Force One in 1963. The Johnson family in 1965, and the Humphreys there too. And Jimmy Carter being sworn in 1977. Notice in this one the informal dress which Jimmy Carter espoused at that time rather than the formal black tie or white tie. Another major unique event is a presidential funeral. These two have been photographically documented throughout the years. A stereo view of Lincoln's cortege passing through the streets of New York on April 25th, 1865. And that's the hearse, the big kind of black blot down the middle, is the hearse coming down the street. Another stereo view of New York City Hall draped in mourning for Lincoln. A cabinet card of the remains of Garfield lying in state in the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol in 1881. Cabinet card of ex-President Grant's funeral procession on Broadway in New York City in 1885. Stereo views of McKinley's remains at the White House in 1901, and Harding's body lying in state in the rotunda of the Capitol in 1923, and the tragic and famous photograph of John Kennedy Jr. saluting at his father's funeral in 1963. To finish off on a less somber note, let's look at what I would consider the height of absurdity attained by the photo opportunity of the Reagan years. Ronald Reagan, looking across the demilitarized zone into North Korea and seeing most likely only the lens of the UPI cameraman who took the photograph. Thank you.
Okay, we have some questions. Could I ask the first question?
Sure.
As one looks back at collections of these kinds, is the purpose of a panoramic view of what has happened, is it a reconstruction of the entrepreneurial and advertising process to advertise at the present, or does it help you penetrate the veil? A couple of us spent an hour, as I mentioned to you, an hour and a half with Mr. Reagan's official biographer this morning, and he was talking about the veil, which Nancy Reagan mentioned even in the interview. But suddenly the veil would come down, and he said he had never known anyone in his life, this was Edmund Morris, who revealed himself less than Ronald Reagan. Said about the only spark that he, in all these hours and hours of interviews that he struck off, was that they turned up Ronald Reagan's first girlfriend, Marjorie Cleaver, and Ronald Reagan suddenly flashed up and said, how did you find out about her? And there was a kind of a flare of anger that Morris identified. Otherwise, absolutely bland, unrevealing kind of response. Well, can we understand a Reagan or anybody else from his pictures?
Well, I think if you look at collections of this, and it's very rare you find collections. The exhibit I did several years ago of photographing the presidency from the collection of the Eastman House was never collected as a collection of presidents. It was really just hunting through a vast photographic collection to accumulate them. So I don't think any have been accumulated on that basis. Clearly, from anything I can tell, they were all made for either sale or encouragement of the photographer's career, whatever it was in the later years of press photographers. I think there is very little that can get past the veil of an outside photographer. I think the only place we see that I've seen, because up until really you had a personal photographer of the president, you really only captured the president in public settings. I mean, there wasn't intimate pictures other than portraits, formal portraits. You can read the notes of Coburn or Nicholas Murray taking the pictures of Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, or Calvin Coolidge in the early part of the century, and they had 15 minutes in which to photograph the president to do a formal portrait. So they had to spend 3/4 hour setting up and 15 minutes with the president, and that was it. So you didn't really get past that veil, and the type of photography, the way it was used, you didn't have it. It would always be out in the public. Once you had the personal photographer of the president, and only in some of them, I think you can get past that veil with Gerry Ford. David Hume Kennerly, who was his photographer, was his first appointee. He was extremely close to the family. He could photograph any place in the White House at any time he wanted. And you do see Kennerly's photographs of Ford and the family in much more intimate settings, and you really see the person come through. The other photographers, Johnson certainly didn't give Okamoto his chance. Certainly Richard Nixon did not have the photographer around him all the time the way Kennerly was around Johnson all the time, or around Ford all the time. Jimmy Carter didn't even have a personal photographer. And Michael Evans' own comments was, he was Reagan's photographer, that the president didn't want him around all the time, and he didn't want to be. So I don't think you could ever have gotten past anything but what they wanted to present out in the public. There were times, obviously, if they're out in the public and they're caught by a photographer at a time which is, you know, they're not feeling very, it's not a formal presentation, as I even said about the pictures of Franklin Roosevelt at a ballpark where he was shot by a photographer with a camera and they didn't know the picture was being taken, so therefore the pictures were not very flattering. But I don't think a photographer would ever get past that panel, unless they wanted them to.
Other questions, General Dixon?
With the advent of television, or television cameras being at almost every function, is there any need today of photographs taken simply as private photographs, because you have so much of the television camera?
Well, I think you do, because you need it, you certainly have it for the press, for the printed media, because they wouldn't use the television frames for printed media, wouldn't come out as well. So you still have a huge photographic, there's the press, I think, that is authorized to the White House certified is about over 130 press photographers, right in the White House with their own offices and everything, office there to be used for presidential photography or White House photography. And those are press photographers. Those aren't even the personal photographer present. Those are the press. I think you need it that way. And of course, there's always the desire to have formal portraits of the president, which they even use themselves when they have them in front of ambassadorial offices and everything, embassies. You always see the president's picture up there. And it's usually a formal portrait of the president. It's more manipulated, I think, now. I really do. And I think that clearly has happened with the personal photographer of the president. They release a lot of photographs. That was another interesting factor of Kennerly. Kennerly could release any photograph he wanted without checking with the president. And none of the other personal photographers have had that authority. So there was still an editing process done. That's blocking the veil, or using the veil. Yes, ma'am?
I've read that they have certain backgrounds and props that they use for presidential photographs. Is that true, or can you tell us something about that?
Well, I think you find that in, you found that really has happened with President Reagan, that in any time he goes to speak, the color was controlled behind him. The kind of podium and everything, and of course you always, the presidential seal, I believe, travels with the president whenever he's going, so it's on the podium. But clearly, I believe, you almost always saw Reagan behind a blue background, or in front of a blue background. It was a control of that formal color of the presidency, in a way. But other than that, most of the portraits you find were done, some of them in the White House earlier years, there was not that kind of control. I think it's very much of the way the press is manipulated, photography is manipulated since the Reagan administration. I'm not sure Bush is doing it. I made that comment about, I certainly haven't done a scientific survey, but it's my own just reading of the press and watching the press, and I just haven't seen much. In fact, you didn't see any President Bush, because most of these are from my own personal collection, and I don't have one of President Bush since he's been made president. But I just haven't seen that many exciting images of him in the press. And we see him in his cigarette boat up and outside of Kennebunkport, or now there's some of him out in the at the earthquake in San Francisco. But there really hasn't been much. It's very static. Even on his trips to China or any other places he's gone, you haven't seen many press photos of him. Reagan, you saw them all the time. I mean, he didn't have to do anything, and there was a picture of him in the paper. And I think that's where the manipulation went on. It was very, very effective.
Ms. Craig McCormick.
When did newspapers begin to use photos?
The first use of photography in newspapers, the half-tone print, was in around 1875, when half-tones were made. But it was still fairly primitive, and not really heavily used until about the little past the turn of the century. But 1875 is the date of the first half-tone printed from a photograph. Actually, in Easton House, the collection, they have both the photograph and the plate.
Mr. C.
The quality of that Andrew Jackson photograph is excellent. How long would the exposure have to be for that in those days?
That would probably have been several minutes.
And he
would have had this. The man was practically bedridden at the time these pictures were taken of him. But he would have to sit there. Yeah, that timing. At 45, though, they had moved it, they had tightened it up. The process in the beginning stages, it was a long process. And by, within fairly rapidly within years, they had shortened the time that it took to take those photographs. They also, during those years, certainly up to the time of Lincoln, for portraits, they used the clamp also to hold your head in place, so the head didn't move. And you still find these chairs and the clamps, you can find them. And there are comments about Lincoln's setting with Brady for that Cooper Union portrait was that he had to find an extra long clamp because Lincoln was so tall. And he had to doctor it up to be able to make it happen. But that was really how they handled it. But that one is an exceptional photograph. That daguerreotype, it's it photographs, I say, much better than the daguerreotype looks when you see it, because it's somewhat faded. But luckily, photographers now can do quite a bit with those early ones in making them come out as strong as they did. But the series of him taken, it appears there were two settings. This one when he was wearing his glasses, and another one which was from the, I showed you a daguerreotype or carte de visite of him from Brady. There's controversy over who took the photographs. The same photographs appear with Brady's name on it, with Anthony's name on it, with Langenheim's name on it. Nobody's exactly sure who went out to Hermitage and took the picture. But it was taken in April 1845, just about 2 months before he died.
Professor Fernbach?
Have presidential photographs been doctored very often? What's the art of doctoring? When did that come along?
Well, I don't think you see that. I haven't noticed it. I would bet that some of the early ones probably had some retouching. Mm-hmm. But not until probably the late 1800s that you found retouching really being done on photographs. And it wasn't as common. I don't think you see it now at all, because press photography is so quick that you really don't find that. I would bet anyone doing a formal portrait would touch out wrinkles and things like that if they really do a formal setting portrait for the president.
Of course, your doctor is the person at it before he sits.
That happens too, yes, with the makeup and everything goes with
it. Robin Cozen.
I have a silly question that goes back to Reagan, but a lot of people was shocked when he had the brain surgery on one of the pictures. Do you think that was a planned shot?
Oh, no, I don't think it was planned. That was he was getting off the plane and they took it. I don't think there was a choice. I think he knew what he was doing when he took his cap off. The man knows how to manipulate. I mean, he's an actor. He does a wonderful job of it. I mean, he was effective in how he presented himself to the press and to the people.
Victor.
When you see, thank you. When you see a number of photographs, especially in the history books, of the post-battle scenes in the Civil War, would those be retained by the National Archives or wherever they kept?
The Brady negatives are in the National Archives. They're at the National Archives because I've seen the negatives. I visited once, actually when I was doing this work and for the show I was doing. And I did visit the archives and they showed me where the glass negatives are all kept. And they do make copies from them for people. There's just so many of them that it's very hard to do any careful photographers for Brady, but they would move bodies around so they would get a better aesthetic image out of what they were doing in those ways.
I was wondering why you chose mostly black and whites rather than colored pictures, even if people who were around long after color had been
Most of course it's press photography, and we've only seen until you really saw the picture magazines where color started coming in. And that's why, and most of the pictures I have are press photographs, so most of them were done in black and white to start with. The one you saw of Reagan, of course, was colored because that did come out color from the White House as they issued them. You're finding it now because you're finding much more reproduction of color photography. But until Reagan, you really didn't see too much of it.
Dr. Alder?
You talked about the evidence of aging in sequential pictures of FDR, and also that FDR concealed his physical disability, was successful up to a point, and since then it's been virtually impossible. I wonder in the earlier presidents if there's some evidence that they were, Wilson of course, there's no pictures I'm sure of him with a stroke, but I wonder if any of the earlier ones there's evidence of physical disability. I did notice in Andrew Johnson's picture that it looked to me from here as if he had some kind of a distortion of his hands, perhaps due to pituitary, perhaps due to arthritis, or maybe that was just the foreshortening in the picture. But is there any evidence that's been dug up about presidential disabilities?
No, actually, you don't see any of the pictures I've seen. Even with Cleveland, and of course the jaw surgery, you see nothing in any of the later pictures. And I have a photograph of him taken long after he was out of the White House, before he died, with his wife and children. And you see no distortions in his face at all from it.
Good side.
No, and this is a head-on. I mean, you really don't see anything that would even indicate that there was surgery, and I think they did do that surgery well for him that time. I didn't notice the thing in Johnson. I'll have to look at that one again and see. There are, I think there are one or two pictures of Wilson later, because he did go out once or twice, and I think he was taken in a carriage with Mrs. Wilson. But you really don't see too much. The photography wasn't sharp in that time to be able to capture the real failing of the man. But you definitely do see it in Roosevelt, because it was in so long. And it was a long period of time. You go from 37 to mid-40s, you got 7 years or so, when that picture of him signing a bill is. And the one picture, which I don't have in this group, but of Roosevelt at Yalta, you distinctly see the man as an old, aged, ill man. And I think that's the one that you notice it probably most. I don't know if anyone has noticed the photographs of President Reagan in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. And he's definitely, he's gray. I mean, clearly the hair has grown in gray. but
when Morris said it really started the last year.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah, aging. But you also see how aged he is in these pictures. They really are showing, and maybe the surgery and everything else on top of it has not helped him. But I think that's more distinct than I've seen in any of the other presidents.
Bill Harbilly.
Are you aware of any relationship between press photography and commercial advertising photography? I specifically have in mind this. They seem to always catch Nancy Reagan with a dog pulling her every time they return from the campaign. And then you have this Revlon girl being pulled by these dogs and her hair flying around. Is it relationship? Is this a copy?
No, I don't think so. Maybe people steal the idea. I wouldn't be surprised. And I would blame that on an advertising artist, art director, than I would on a photographer. Because predominantly the press photographers don't do commercial work. There are very few of them who bridge those kinds. The ones who would cover the White House and everything are strictly that's what they do. There are other known photographers who will do both. But I would think that might be just some enterprising art director who captured an image and tried to trade off it. There are, and I think you can see, is the press often will, sometimes they will print less flattering photographs of certain people.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And Mrs. Reagan has often been a target that way. And I think it was, you know, the attitudes around Mrs. Reagan lent that among some of the press to do that, because they often captured her in very less flattering pictures than, I mean, the woman's a very attractive woman, and somehow the pictures never turned out that way a long time.
Other questions? Jack Owen?
Was Brady a New York photographer, or did he come from somewhere else and then finally wind up in New York?
I think he had a studio in New York first. Mm-hmm. He then went to Washington. I don't know where he originally came from. I never did check the birth.
I don't know what...
He had a studio in Washington.
I don't know the difference between the carte de visite and the cabinet.
The carte de visite is about...
About three inches by two inches. Card.
It was a business card type. The idea in carte de visite was developed in France by Desdary in the early 1850s. And it was really meant almost as a calling card with a photograph on it that people started giving to friends and family.
So
it was small, and the cameras were able to...
A little large.
The cabinet card would be about three inches wide, but about maybe five by three. So it was a different format.
I have photographs taken by, at least presumably Brady, signed Brady anyway, of my grandparents in the late 1860s in Princeton, Indiana. And I wondered if that's where...
Could be Brady's studio. He might have run a studio. I'm just trying to think of if there's size. Well, these are smaller than a cabinet card would normally be. Mm-hmm. Cabinet card would be a little larger than that. and a carte de visite. Well, the carte de visite you can see over here of Johnson. You can see the size of that. That's almost the
calling
size.
Calling card.
Yeah, it's a calling card size. And the cabinet cards are larger. Yeah. But Brady, it could very well, they traveled, that Brady might have taken them someplace else. Often, some of the photographers with prominent people would copy other people's negatives. And you will find a lot of images that were Brady originally of Lincoln that were copied by others. And you can, as it gets copied, it loses, as one generation further down, it loses detail and it loses the sharpness. And you see some fairly weak images of the same picture that was originally a Brady photograph. Brady was a very fine photographer, and he did a lot of important work, actually, of people all over from that period of time.
You mentioned Haley using the camera in preparation. Was he one of our earliest American artists to do that?
Well, I don't know if he... my question is, I don't know if he used it for his preparation for his paintings. He did do painting of Polk. He took a picture. The quotes on that day that Healy was there was Healy was with Polk taking pictures of him in the cabinet. And then when they left and went downstairs, Mrs. Polk was with the ladies, including Dolly Madison. This is all from the memoirs. And Healy prevailed upon them to take a picture of him outside. And he said none of them survived. And clearly one did, because that is distinctly the group of people that he referred to, because the other people in the cabinet were the Postmaster General, the Secretary of the Treasury, and some relatives of Mrs. Polk. So, but I don't think the Polk photograph, and yet it might, I mean the painting of Polk, Delia Polk, might look like a daguerreotype he took. That daguerreotype doesn't exist, at least that I don't know of. Could be at the National Portrait Gallery. But clearly he did Lincoln, he did most of the presidents in that period of time, and he might very well have used the camera as a tool.
As a tool? Mm-hmm.
Many photographers have, many artists have.
Has anybody done for portraits what you've done for photography of presidents?
The paintings, not that I know of, but you might find something out of the Portrait Gallery. Mm-hmm. National Portrait Gallery, of course, has a fine collection. Yeah. I don't know if they have.
But no one has written.
I haven't seen it. You see books on it, but they tend to be one painting of each president. You don't see a kind of trail of the different images or such. I of course, only used the collection of Eastman House for doing that article when I did the exhibit, and I didn't even cover all of the pictures I used in the exhibit because there were just so much you could print. Nonprofit organizations don't have those budgets.
Trina?
Are there pictures of the first ladies?
Yes.
Just as showing the changes?
You do see the first ladies right through. There are daguerreotypes of some of the first ladies. There is a daguerreotype. I'm not sure, they may be in Chicago, I'm not sure where they are, but there is one of Mrs. Lincoln. There's also a daguerreotype named Abraham Lincoln early on. And you do find some of as the daguerreotypes, you find Mrs. Hayes, I think Mrs. Polk, Mrs. Pierce.
Mrs. Pierce?
Yes.
Wasn't she the one supposed to be such a recluse?
Yes, but I think there are pictures of her. I'm pretty sure that I've seen one of her. There's a very good book called Facing the Light that was published by the National Portrait Gallery on an exhibit of daguerreotypes that they did. And it has a lot of wonderful photograph reproductions of many prominent people, not only presidents and first ladies, but others, Lewis Cass and a lot of the other prominent people from that period of time. And it's an excellent book and documents all the known daguerreotypes of the people that it deals with and has where they're located. Also some that we know from, like, some of those that are taken from daguerreotypes. The daguerreotype might not exist, but we know one did exist. And they have used that and documented that in that book. It's an excellent book, and that's one where I've seen the presidents, the first lady. But you do find, as you saw Mrs. Grant, with Grant and his son, so you see them in stereo cards. You find cabinet cards, quite frequently of some of the president, first ladies. There's a wonderful pair of them, which I have of. One is of Mrs. Harrison, and one's of Mrs. Cleveland. And next to it is imposed a picture of Martha Washington on both of them. And you find a little of that kind of thing to tie back. Actually, there's the morbidity, in a sense, also of stereo cards. You found, at the time of McKinley's death, you would find stereo cards issued with a picture of Lincoln, Garfield, and McKinley, our martyred presidents. And, you know, a little morbid, but they obviously had a sale potential at that time. But you find the same kind of photographs. As you saw Mrs. Taft in some of the postcards, you find the same thing in later years going on up in the press photography.
In the Philippines, we're reminded with the Marcos death, it's very commonplace to take pictures of the open casket. When was that done, and when did it stop being done?
I've only seen one photograph of an open casket, and that's Lincoln. There is one known photograph taken, although it was supposedly banned, but it was taken, of Lincoln in the casket. I don't have pictures, I've never seen any picture of any of the other presidents in open caskets. But that one exists. In the book I mentioned, The Face of Lincoln, they do have a reproduction of that photograph.
How common is the business of taking pictures of individuals who meet with the president? When Reagan was here for one of his farewell addresses, well, a little group of us met with him in the Rotunda Dome Room, and we were all formed in a circle, and we were paraded around, and the photographer took pictures of each of us with Reagan.
I think that's been going on for... I have seen some going back, as far as Johnson that I know, but I would bet it was even earlier. Yeah, I would think that's very common. That's why they had the military photographer in the White House who would take pictures of the president with people, because you see so many congressional offices or such of a congressman with the president or other people. And I mean, it's fairly common. I would think now with the press office itself, the office of the personal photographer to the president, that's not just one person. I mean, he is the personal photographer, but there may be two or three other people in the staff so that they can take those pictures when those occasions occur. Actually, there is now a personal photographer, the vice president. In fact, just before they went into office, a young photographer who had just graduated from Rochester Institute of Technology went down to be Dan Quayle's photographer. The papers in Rochester. Yeah, getting ready. Well, you build a wonderful portfolio there for future use.
Okay. Yes, General Biss.
Do or did recent presidents' advisors contrive so-called photo opportunities, or are they really opportunities?
I think they're contrived, and I don't remember the term used before, but I'm not remembering right, but I think that really developed in President Reagan's.
Yeah, just recently.
Yeah, very recent. And they're really opportunities just to have him pictured. Those are the ones, remember, Sam Donaldson and some of the others would shout questions to him and he just wouldn't answer. But there he's with somebody else. You do see photographs, and I have seen one of President Eisenhower with Nehru. So you can see that they were taken, I mean, sitting on a sofa, obviously, in the White House. I think they did that a lot. But this has been much more used during the Reagan presidency. And now it's common. I mean, you hear photo opportunity, you know there's nothing happening. There's no announcements. There's just the chance for photographers to come in and take a picture of the president with somebody or doing supposedly something, signing a bill or something like that. And you can see they were used even during Roosevelt's days where signing bills were photograph. I'm sure that was given out to every one of those people who were sitting behind them.
Well, this has opened up a whole new area for us, Don. Terribly grateful to you. And at age 56, Bob is somebody who has a long future ahead of him, and who knows, he may even turn up in places like Washington, so we follow his career with great interest.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.